morning. We are delighted to see you all, but a special welcome comes to a second group of students from Wauwatosa East High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you for standing and thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. This program invites students to come to court, listen to an oral argument, and then have a conversation with a justice of the court assigned for the conversation on the particular day. And the conversation will be about the procedures and processes of this court in taking cases, hearing cases, and deciding cases. The discussion will not involve the substantive issues of the cases. The program is cleverly entitled Court with Class. Before I introduce the court to all of you, if any of you wish a summary of this case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. It's easier to listen to oral argument if you have a summary of the case and understand it. Let me introduce court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice who will meet with you today, right after this case, and you'll be joined by the Wauwatosa East High School students who were here for the first case. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice David Prosser, and seated to his right is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Robensack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our next case, which is 10 AP 1599 CR, State versus Leroy Kane. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Kane is Fawn M. Moses, Assistant State Public Defender. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Fawn Moses, and I represent the petitioner, Mr. Leroy Kane. The issues in this case concern what a circuit court's duties are when taking a plea when a defendant denies an element of the offense to which he is pleading, and also what a reviewing court may consider when deciding whether a circuit court erred in refusing plea withdrawal in this type of situation. Despite the state's lengthy dedication to the issue of whether the number of marijuana plants is an element, it appears that the parties agree that a fact that must be charged, must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and found by a jury to allow for a conviction to that offense is an element. Specifically, the United States Supreme Court in Apprendi versus New Jersey held that any fact other than a fact of a prior conviction that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to a jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Mr. Kane believes Apprendi resolves the element issue in his favor in this case. Here, the charge at issue and the charge Mr. Kane pled to and to which he remains convicted of is manufacturing more than four marijuana plants, a Class H felony. At the plea hearing in this case, Mr. Kane explicitly denied that he had more than four plants. He specifically stated, "I had four plants, that was it." Despite Mr. Kane's denial of this element, the court did not inquire into Mr. Kane's statement and ultimately accepted his plea. At a post-conviction hearing, the court refused to allow Mr. Kane to withdraw his plea, stating that his plea was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. At that post-conviction hearing, the state mentioned a statement made by Cain at sentencing about him having 5 plants. Regardless, the circuit court did not inquire into the statement at sentencing, nor did it inquire into Mr. Cain's denial of the element at the plea hearing. The Court of Appeals acknowledged the holding in Johnson that when a defendant denies an element of an offense to which they are pleading, the court is required to reject the plea and set the matter for trial, yet did not follow that holding. Instead, the Court of Appeals concluded that in this case, Mr. Cain directly and unambiguously admitted the element at sentencing that he had 5 plants, and therefore no manifest injustice existed in not allowing Mr. Cain to withdraw his plea. Mr. Cain proposes a couple different rules in this case, the first of which is to reaffirm the holding from Johnson, that when a defendant denies an element of the offense to which he or she is pleading no contest or guilty to, a court must reject the plea unless it concludes the plea is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent by either conducting additional inquiry or accepting the plea as an Alford plea. The second rule is that when conducting a manifest injustice analysis where a defendant denies an element at the plea hearing, a reviewing court should be limited to what happened prior to the plea hearing and at the plea hearing itself. However, if this court does conclude that a reviewing court may consider the entire record, including the sentencing, when determining a plea's validity in these circumstances, Mr. Cain asks this court to conclude that the Court of Appeals erred when it found that Mr. Cain directly and unambiguously admitted the element at issue at the sentencing hearing. We also ask
Ms. Moses, let me ask you about 2 cases. You've argued about Johnson, and I understand what the rule was in Johnson. But 28 years later, this court made a decision in a case called State versus Thomas. And in State versus Thomas, while looking at manifest injustice, the court also talked about the fact that in wrestling with an issue such as this one, you can look at the whole record, the totality of the circumstances. So you've got a situation where the defendant here says 4 plants. However, his attorney then stipulates to the factual basis being presented to support the plea as set forth in the criminal complaint, which I understand says approximately 16 plants. Then you've got the defendant at sentencing talking about the fact that it's 5 plants. Now, when the court looks at all of that, looks at the totality of the circumstances, why should we not apply State versus Thomas and say under the totality of the circumstances, you've got the attorney stipulating to the facts as a factual basis as set forth in the complaint. You've got the defendant agreeing to 5 plants at sentencing. Where is the manifest injustice?
The manifest injustice results in this type of case, it's not a factual basis case. It's not about whether or not there was a factual basis for the offense. As you stated, the attorney at the plea hearing did state that there was factual basis, and there's numerous reasons why this case is not a factual basis case, but this case is about what happened at the plea hearing. And you know, cases from Banger and many other cases state that at a plea hearing, the trial court must exercise utmost solicitude in ensuring that the plea is made knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. In this case, at the plea hearing, the defendant denies an element of the offense that he's pleading to. And therefore, at that time, what should have been done is the plea hearing should have been halted or there should have been additional inquiry. The statement in this case at sentencing was never asked about, never inquired about. It came up at sentencing, and I've talked about it in my brief, but it's an offhand statement that's made where Mr. Cain is alleged to have said that there was 5 plants that got excavated. He didn't say, I had 5 plants. The focus when reviewing a case for a manifest injustice should be limited to, in this case, what happened at the plea hearing, because that's the time that the person is entering in, or that their conviction is accepted to that offense. So it's different than factual basis cases where a reviewing court can examine the entire record to see if there's a factual basis for the offense. In this case, Mr. Cain specifically denied an element of the offense to which he was pleading. Therefore, his plea, his conviction is invalid. He didn't admit it, and a jury was then required to either find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in order to sustain his conviction, in order for the conviction to be valid.
Except in Thomas, the court specifically says you can look at the sentencing here. You can look at the whole record. You can look at what was going on at the plea hearing. You can look at what was going on at the time of the sentencing. You can look at the whole record to determine whether or not there's been a manifest injustice. And if you look at it, I have trouble coming to the conclusion that there's some manifest injustice here. Thomas also made it quite clear that some of the older case law that seemed to say any sufficient reason is a manifest injustice. We backed away from that in Thomas. We made it quite clear that it's not that easy. There's a clear and convincing evidence standard that is now applied. And I'm having trouble understanding, how do you get to manifest injustice?
Well, the manifest injustice, there are cases, Krieger and Griffin, that also state that a manifest injustice can be found in the process which led to the conviction or in the procedure. It can be inherent in the procedure. It just doesn't necessarily have to be on the merits. In this case, the manifest injustice happened because Mr. Cain's plea was accepted when he denied an element of the offense. Therefore, his plea is not knowing, voluntary, intelligent. It's an invalid plea. And there's cases that say a manifest injustice exists when a plea is not knowing, voluntary, or intelligent. And that's this case. This plea is not knowing, voluntary, or intelligent. It's inconsistent with a knowing, voluntary, intelligent plea when you have a defendant who is denying an element of the offense that they're pleading to.
Counsel, let me go down a slightly different path with you. The plea that he entered was for manufacturing or delivering controlled substance under 96141(1H)(2), right? And the underlying offense, if submitted to a jury, would have two elements, right?
The underlying offense has three.
Well, let's talk about that. And that's where I think we're getting stuck. And I want to make sure we're on the same path. As I understand it, or my recollection of trying these cases was, you instruct the jury on two elements. They determine if the defendant is guilty or not guilty of the offense charged. And then they go on to determine the quantity or amount. And they could answer that question yes or no. Is that your understanding, or has it changed, or is there something I'm missing?
The jury instructions that I've referred to are a little bit different. They refer to three elements, and then you go to, if guilt is found on those three elements, then you would go to another jury instruction,
okay,
which relates to the amount.
But guilt as to the delivery or the manufacturing has to occur before they determine the amount, right?
Correct.
Okay. So in any event, it's a guilty or not guilty for the underlying charge. Then the jury can say, yes, the state has proven it's more than four plants, or no, the state hasn't proven it's more than four plants, right?
Correct.
If the state doesn't prove that it's more than four plants, does that mean the person is not guilty?
Well, in this case, the state charged Mr. Cain with the Class H felony.
Right, but if you could, just answer my question. Does that mean the person is not guilty?
If that's the charge that they're charged with, then they're not guilty of that charge. They have to have a lesser included charge. You know, an I felony also needed to be charged if the person would then be found guilty of a lesser charge.
Okay, so in your view, the failure of the jury to determine that the state met its burden of proof that there were more than four plants means that the guilty determination by the jury becomes a not guilty.
Yes.
Okay. All right, because I was going to ask you if you think the sentence ought to be commuted, essentially, that if the state couldn't prove that there are more than four plants, should the real determination, instead of being withdrawal of plea, be the state can only prove that there were less than four. They proved that there was manufacture or delivery. They just didn't prove the four plants. And here his sentence was probation anyway, so it would only come into play if he were sent back for sentencing to prison, right?
Correct.
Okay, but you don't like that idea.
No, and I think that the correct remedy here is plea withdrawal, because it's a defect that happened at the plea hearing. There's a problem with the plea. His plea is invalid because he's denied this element of the offense. There's nothing wrong here with his sentence. We're not claiming that he was sentenced beyond that maximum. It is irrelevant against what the sentence is that he got. His conviction remains to a Class H felony.
Okay. So like in a drunk driving case, if someone were found guilty of a specific guilty of the first two elements and then were called upon to determine the alcohol level but found the state didn't meet its burden of proof there, that would make it a not guilty in your mind?
Correct. I'm not that familiar with the OWI laws off the top of my head, but that sounds like that's what I'm trying to say as well.
I'm just trying to follow it through because there are various contexts in the criminal law where the underlying offense has certain elements, but then to determine where they fit for sentencing purposes, the jury has to make a finding as to level of something, you know, DC while armed, or delivery of a certain amount, or prohibited alcohol concentration, but the level is a certain level. And typically, it doesn't mean that that's a not guilty. Typically, that would just mean the state hadn't proven that level, but I understand what you're saying now. Thank
That's
you.
Correct. I can also elaborate on that a little bit, and I did address this in my briefs, but State v. Warbleton and also State v. Harvey and State v. Villarreal, those cases are similar to this case. State v. Warbleton was a case where it involved a stalking statute, and the defendant was charged with stalking with a prior conviction for a violent crime, and that was a Class H felony, similar to this case. There was also a stalking crime without that previous conviction for a violent crime that was a Class I felony. And in that case, the state charged Mr. Warbleton with the Class H felony, and this court determined that the prior conviction for a violent crime was an element of that offense. It made that fact, that prior conviction of a violent crime, made it a different offense. It made it the Class H offense versus without that, it would only be the Class I offense. And this case is similar to that. Okay. Mr. Cain's charged with growing more than four plants, which that offense, that specific offense, is a Class H felony.
That's because this relates to count three. There were several counts. They were dropped. Others were dropped, right?
Correct.
Count three says in the complaint that the defendant manufactured a controlled substance in an amount of more than 200 grams, but not more than 1,000, or more than four plants, but not more than 20, contrary to 961.41(1)(h)(2), a Class H felony, subject to not more than 10,000 for 6 years. Is that a correct complaint? I mean, that 6 years is the amount of time?
Yes, for a Class H felony, the maximum is 6 years.
They could have charged just 961.41(1)(h) without referring to two and could have not charged how many plants?
Correct, and then it would be a Class I felony, which would be a maximum penalty of 3.5 years.
Okay. All right. Now, this is a case after sentencing, right?
Correct.
And what you want to do is go back to square one, right?
Yes.
So, and you say you do that only if, and you do that here because the facts don't meet the complaint. For the facts that are in the record, or at least at the plea hearing, show that all the elements have not been met.
Correct. We allege that the complaint is, I mean, the facts in the complaint, we aren't alleging that there's anything wrong with the facts that are in the complaint.
Right.
The problem here is that Mr. Cain denied the element that would establish that conviction to the count three of the complaint, more than four plants.
Is this a Bangert case?
No, it's not a Bangert case. And it's kind of...
It's not a Brown case either?
No, it's not a Bangert case, not a Brown case, not a factual basis case. It's kind of a unique case in its own sense of where it's because the defendant is denying something that they're pleading to, it makes it an invalid plea.
Counselor, if you prevail here, then what will happen is this matter will be returned to the circuit court and Mr. Keene will be tried on everything that he was charged with, not just the one item that there was a defective plea on, correct?
Yes, Mr. Keene understands that.
Counsel, in response to questions, I thought I heard you arguing a little more with regard to element of the offense and the number of plans, a little more broadly than the Court of Appeals held. As I understood the Court of Appeals, and they set it forth in a footnote, and in that footnote they said, you know, in this case, in this sense, it's the number of plans is an element of the offense because that question has to be submitted to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So in this kind of a case, because of that, it's not that it is an element of the offense, but the last sentence in footnote 9 says, we need not and do not address the question of whether element would necessarily be the appropriate term to use for the plant quantity issue in other contexts. Are you arguing more broadly than this footnote 9 or consistent with it? It's not clear to me.
Well, I'm arguing in this case it was an element in Mr. Kane's case. The charge that he was convicted of and pled to involved this fact that increases the penalty beyond that base I felony, which if there were no amount alleged, or then he could only be convicted of that if that was something that was that he was charged with. So in this case, because he said he had four plants and he had to, there had to be evidence, or he can't deny that he had more than four plants. In this case, he said, I had four plants. So it kind of fits, you know, right at that threshold of from an I felony to an H felony, and applying Apprendi, that's what Apprendi says, is that when there's a fact that increases the penalty, the statutory maximum, it's a fact that has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt found by a jury. So in this case, we're arguing that the number of plants is an element of the offense that Mr. Keene pled to.
So what does footnote 9 mean to you?
Footnote 9 means that, I'm not entirely sure, I guess, but maybe in circumstances where the state doesn't allege a specific amount of drugs, maybe they mean that then it can't be an element. In that case, it wouldn't have to be proven by a jury. A defendant could be found guilty of having an unspecified number of drugs, and that would enable them to have an I conviction, class I conviction.
You think it's because it was the complaint said H2 and then set forth what H2 is, that's what causes this case to be an element?
Yes. In this specific case, it has to be more than four plants, and he denied that element. He said, I only had four plants at the plea hearing.
Counsel, what is the definition of element that you would like us to apply to this case?
Well, in my research, I've actually looked into it a little bit because there's not a specific definition of what an element is all around. But what we would like the definition to be is an element is something, it's a fact that has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt and found by a jury.
How should we reconcile that definition with the different cases from around the federal circuit courts of appeal, which seems to take the tack that an element goes to the proscribed conduct, that is, the manufacture, the growing, in this case, of the plant. And anything that goes to the quantity, it seems to me several courts around the country have taken the position that that is an element that might go to an enhanced sentence, but not to the prescribed conduct itself.
Well, the federal cases are split on this issue, especially after Apprendi, but the majority of them have decided that it is an element if the fact increases the penalty. So in cases where they said that it hasn't been an element, it's been where the state didn't allege a specific amount or it fell in that default maximum penalty, and the person didn't get a sentence beyond
right, so,
that.
Right, so what they've said is that if the sentence imposed does not exceed the default maximum penalty, which in this instance, 2 years probation, your client received 2 years probation, I believe, right?
Correct.
So that did not exceed the base maximum penalty. So that would be in conformity with those federal courts that have taken the position that it's an element of increased sentencing only and not to the underlying prescribed conduct.
Well, and those cases also involve Apprendi errors. We're not claiming that this is an Apprendi error. An Apprendi error in those cases related to a sentencing error, that the defendant received a sentence beyond the statutory maximum and either the fact wasn't submitted to the jury to be found, and that was what happened, I guess, in most cases. Here, an Apprendi is made clear that it's a fact that exposes a defendant to an increased penalty.
And that
is the determination that you would make in whether or not something would be an element or not.
But just stepping back and looking at it, could it not be both? Could it not be an element of the underlying prescribed conduct, that is the manufacturer, and an element that would have to be established or proven to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt for the increased penalty? Couldn't it be both?
If I understand you correctly, I mean, I think that it's an element, in this case, it's an element of the offense that he was charged with, that he pled to, and that he's been convicted of. It was an element, you know, it's an element of the offense, and yes, it does also determine the penalty, but it's an element of a Class H felony, the number of plants in this case is. And it also, I mean, it goes to the sentence as well. And if I didn't answer your question clearly, if you can maybe clarify for me, I can...
You did fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I ask a question about the facts here? There was a search warrant executed?
Yes.
And when that search warrant was returned, it said there were 16 plants?
16? Is that what you just said? 16. I believe that it said there was between 15 and 20. I don't remember if there was an exact number.
Okay. Was there ever any evidence taken about what was found at the gentleman's house?
I believe there was. There was a list of exhibits. Mr. Cain pled on the day that he was going to go to trial. So there was a list of exhibits that did list some evidence of drugs. However, that was another issue. I mean, that's what he's disputing the entire time at the plea hearing is that he didn't have these. He only had four plants. These drugs weren't mine. Everybody's lying. They planted this stuff. I mean, you get the sense that he's being railroaded into entering a plea. And all of this is being ignored, and his plea's accepted.
Well, did he really contend that none of the plants were his?
He said at the plea hearing, I had four plants.
Okay, so when he talked about, you have a lying detective here that planted stuff in my house, do I have to sit and listen to these lies? Was his contention that, I had four plants, but the other plants that were listed were planted by the detective?
That may have been, I don't know that for a fact for sure.
Didn't he say, so I go along with whatever you people say in here?
Yes, he did say that as well.
Isn't that, and what was in the complaint was stipulated by counsel?
Well, that statement, though, I don't interpret it the way that you maybe interpreted it. I don't think that you can get one interpretation from that when he said, I go along with what you people say in here, maybe going along with the proceeding. I don't know exactly what he meant by that statement.
Is this defendant a troubled defendant?
Is he a what?
A troubled defendant.
No, he's not. He's a veteran. I mean, he works. He has a pottery business. He's had some mental health issues in the past, but I don't believe he has a criminal record. Or lengthy criminal record. I don't think he's troubled.
You said at the sentencing hearing he made an offhand comment about five plants. Were the comments about the lying detectives offhand comments or were they serious comments?
Well, the statement that he actually made at the sentencing, before he said the statement about the five plants, he says, there wasn't no quantity of marijuana in my house. It was a joint. And those five plants which got excavated, that's what was in my house. I have no reason to lie about this. I mean, maybe he meant it, that's the five plants that got excavated that they planted there. I mean, it's one statement that the Court of Appeals relies on to say that he's now admitted this element and that his conviction can stand. Ignoring his statement preceding that, no quantity of marijuana in my house, it's very ambiguous and conflicting from the statement he made at the plea hearing, which is the statement that where they're discussing the elements, the, you know, what the crime is and where his conviction ends up being, to a Class H felony. That's the only time that, you know, four plants was mentioned at that time.
Is there anything significant about the fact that he didn't ask to withdraw his plea at the sentencing hearing or before the sentencing hearing?
I was not his counsel at that time, so I don't know what happened then. I just, you know, at that time you have a right to withdraw your plea before sentencing or after, and there's different standards that are put in place at that time. You know, we have to meet a higher burden at this point to try to withdraw a plea after sentencing, but I feel like we have met that standard, and there is a manifest injustice in this case because he denied an element at the plea, yet his plea was still taken. So he has a conviction for a Class H felony. Regardless of his sentence being probation, and he's off probation, he has a conviction to a higher class felony, which, you know, could makes him seem like a, you know, more of a drug dealer or whatnot, but that conviction is an invalid conviction to that offense. And my red light is on, so thank you.
And he's off probation now. Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thomas Balestrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I think the basic dispute between public defender and the Attorney General in this case is whether quantity is an element of a drug offense. We take the position that quantity is not now and never has been an element of any drug offense, including the offense of manufacturing a controlled substance, in this case, growing marijuana. So it's our contention, always has been our contention, that the fact that Mr. Cain may have denied growing a particular number of marijuana plants at the time he entered his plea is absolutely irrelevant since it's not an element of the offense.
Can I just ask you a question that was asked of defense counsel? What does the word element mean? Now, my understanding of Apprendi was that the states might define manufacturing differently, right? And as a federal constitutional issue of whether the, for lack of a better word, the element, in quotes, has to go to the jury, the court said, hey, we're not going to look at how you define element. You know, the statute could have said elements are 1, 2, 3, 4, and then say, and you increase penalty, which isn't defined by the statute as an element. So the court said in Apprendi, quote, other than the fact of a prior conviction, any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to a jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so why isn't this an element?
Well, because the mere fact that something has to be submitted to the jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt, or in our case, admitted by the defendant who is entering a concessional plea, does not necessarily mean it's an element of the crime.
Okay.
It can be either of two things. It can be either an element of the crime, or, as I have suggested in my brief, if we want to use the term element as a generic term, it can be an element of the penalty, not an element of the crime. It can be an element that is not necessary to prove that the defendant committed those acts that are necessary to constitute a criminal offense. It can be only an element or a fact that is necessary to increase the penalty for the crime of which the defendant has been convicted from the default statutory maximum to something above the default maximum. And I think the critical thing, speaking of Apprendi, I think the one really critical sentence in Apprendi, beyond the one that you quoted, is another sentence that I quote on page 4 of my brief, just a couple of paragraphs down from the sentence that you quoted. The court said, an increase beyond the maximum statutory sentence is the functional equivalent of an element of a greater offense. Not that it is an element, but that it's the functional equivalent. And what did the court mean by the functional equivalent? Well, you look at what function is. The function is that it has to be pleaded, it has to be proved. That's the function of this. So in that sense, has to be pleaded, has to be proved, then it's what we call an element. And going on to the rest of that sentence, it's the functional element of a greater offense than the one covered by the jury's guilty verdict. In other words, Apprendi in this particular sentence, I think, makes absolutely clear that the fact necessary to increase the penalty is not something that goes to the jury's guilty verdict. It goes only to the penalty. So I think the U.S. Supreme Court did us a great misservice in Apprendi by messing up the language.
No, but we can't do anything about that. We just have to try and understand it and apply it. Now, my question to you is, if there had been a jury trial here and you instructed the jury, would you instruct that they had to find that he had between 5 and 20 plants?
Yes, you would, but that doesn't cover the whole issue. The question is, when do you instruct them, and in what context do you instruct them?
So let's instruct them without telling them how much he had to have, okay? And they come back and say, guilty, all right?
Okay.
We don't have special verdicts, right? So now do you send them back in and ask
how
much?
Well, in this situation, we do have a special verdict.
You said when, okay? So I'm going to do a when. All right. Okay. Now they come back guilty. Do we need anything else from this jury?
Yes, we do.
Okay. What do we need?
We need a determination of the amount of controlled substance manufactured by the defendant for the purpose not of finding guilt, which the jury has already found, but we need that additional finding for the purpose of determining the appropriate penalty.
Okay. So your position here then is when you have something that can be given to the jury as a second issue of how much marijuana we're talking about, then that isn't a part of the factual basis for the defendant in making a plea. Is that your position?
No, actually it's not.
Right, tell me what your position is.
My position would be that the factual basis for the plea, and we have to separate here, I think it's very critical throughout this discussion to separate the plea and the sentence, the crime from the penalty. I think we have to, there's a clear dichotomy there, and we have to keep those two things absolutely separate. For purposes of finding a defendant guilty of committing the crime of manufacturing a controlled substance, you don't have to find quantity. That's all you have to find is that he manufactured a controlled substance. So, in this particular case, a factual basis for the plea would have been established simply by showing that Leroy Cain grew a marijuana plant, one marijuana plant. That establishes the factual basis. Now, it doesn't establish a factual basis for an increased penalty. What I've just said doesn't establish the factual basis. To establish the factual basis for an increased penalty, you have to establish a factual basis for a finding that he was growing more than four marijuana plants. And here there was the factual basis to show that he was growing 16.
So under Brown, under Bangert, does the colloquy have to show a factual basis for finding that he grew more than one plant?
Not for the purpose of the guilty plea to the crime. It does not, the factual basis does not have to show that he grew any more than one plant to establish a factual basis to find him guilty of manufacturing a controlled substance.
Oh, are you going to sentence him then?
I'm sorry?
How are you going to sentence him?
As I said, that's a separate issue. That's a totally separate issue.
Well, all right, but you got a plea,
yeah,
and he denies the quantity. Okay.
Right.
Now you do a sentencing. Defendant says zero. Nobody else says anything else. How does the judge sentence him if we buy your theory?
If you have a situation where a defendant denies growing more than four marijuana plants,
right,
and there is no factual basis to prove that he grew more than four marijuana plants, what you do is you sentence him to a crime, you impose a sentence that is no greater than the default maximum for the crime of manufacturing a controlled substance.
Even if nothing was charged but the Class H felony, you're
absolutely
going to convict him of a Class I on a plea?
Yes.
And he's had no notice that he's being charged with a Class I?
Well, he is charged with a Class I. That's the default crime.
That's the position that some of the federal cases take.
That's the position of all the federal cases.
What about the Wisconsin cases? What about Harvey? Justice Sykes wrote in Harvey, it should be noted that even before Apprendi, penalty enhancers in this state, other than repeater penalty enhancers based upon a defendant's prior conviction, a second offense OWI, third offense OWI, have been considered to constitute additional elemental facts that must be submitted to the jury. How do you get around that in your argument?
I don't get around it at all. There's no need to get around it.
Okay.
Because what you just quoted are the words penalty enhancer. Those are the critical words of Harvey. Penalty enhancer, not element of the crime. It's an element of something that enhances the penalty.
It's an elemental fact that must be submitted to the jury.
No question about it. Yeah, we agree. Under Apprendi. Under Apprendi, if you want to increase the penalty above the statutory default, you have to prove the fact that it increases the penalty. That doesn't make it an element of the offense. That makes it an element of the penalty.
Well, how is that then to be distinguished here from the OWI? How does that play out? Because that's what the distinction is. Penalty enhancers in this state, other than repeater penalty enhancers based upon a defendant's prior conviction, have been considered to constitute additional elemental facts that must be submitted to the jury. Your argument would give no moment or no gravity to any distinction made here between penalty enhancers and prior convictions based on repeated offenses. So
I do make a distinction. I make a distinction between a fact that's whatever label you want to call it, you want to call it a penalty enhancer, you want to call it an element, I don't care what you call it. Let's look at the function. Let's look at what Apprendi says is a functional equivalent. What does this do? What does this fact that the state has to allege in the complaint prove to a jury? What does that fact do? Does it make the defendant guilty of committing the crime? Or if he has committed the crime, does it simply subject him to a greater penalty?
How do you get around then the holding and the discussion in Harvey that ultimately Harvey was a case, for others' benefits, that dealt with drug offense, I think, within 1,000 feet of a city park or something like that. And the court goes on to say, with reference to the distance, proof of one without the other would be insufficient for conviction. We read the statute as containing not one element with a subpart, but two elemental facts, a distance requirement and a particularized protected area, both of which must be submitted to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, well, I think in Harvey you kind of fell into the same trap that the U.S. Supreme Court fell into in Apprendi, and that is not making a clear distinction between facts that are necessary to prove the crime and facts that are necessary to prove the penalty, and in using imprecise language, in particular, the imprecise word element.
I won't tell Justice Sykes that.
Mr. Balistrieri, if for example, that. Someone were charged with delivery of a controlled substance and the charge was enhanced, the penalty is different because it happens within a school zone. And they go to trial and the jury finds them guilty of delivery, but they don't find that the state met its burden of proof that it was within the school zone. Does that become a not guilty?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. He is still guilty of the crime, which is delivering, or in our case, manufacturing, a controlled substance, regardless of where he does it. I don't care where a defendant delivers a controlled substance. He can do it in a school. He can do it in a church. He can do it in a park. He can do it out in the middle of the wilderness, you know, the Nicolet National Forest. He's still guilty of delivering a controlled substance. But if he does it in a certain place, like within a certain distance of a school or a park or something, then he's subject to a greater penalty for the delivery, which is a crime wherever he does the delivery.
Counselor, I want to be sure I understand your argument. Let's just say that he is charged with having 200 marijuana plants, subjects him to a Class F felony. Pretty significant. And at the plea hearing, he does the same thing he does here. He says, I had between 50 and 200. So he says, I had 49 plants. And the judge accepts his plea. Judge also has provided to him the complaint, and the attorney says the facts in the complaint are a factual basis for the crime charged. What can the judge sentence him to based on those circumstances?
If the defendant refuses to admit the facts that are necessary to bump the penalty up one more step.
Well, it'd be several steps in my example.
Well, your example was 49.
Yeah, well, it's a Class F felony. I mean, what we're looking at, okay, it's up two steps from where you got a Class G that goes in between the H that he was charged with.
Well, forget about the specific number.
But it's more significant is what I'm trying to say to
you.
And so it's not a matter of four plants or five plants. You got someone that's not going to admit to the requisite number. What can the judge sentence him on?
The judge can sentence him to the felony, to the penalty that attaches to the number of plants he admits growing, whether it's 4 or 49. Whatever he admits growing, that's what he can be sentenced for.
Okay, so you're saying that he still has to admit it, just even though you don't want to label it an element of the crime,
right.
You're treating it the same way for a plea because you're not permitting it to
be taken into account for sentencing.
Right.
Okay.
That's why it's a functional element.
Counsel?
He's still, I'm sorry.
If he went to trial on Justice Rogensack's facts and the state only asked for the one question regarding the 200 plants or whatever the number is that was in her hypothetical, and the jury found him guilty of the offense, but did not find that the state met its burden of proof as to the 200 plants or whatever the number is that Justice Rogensack suggests, would that become a not guilty?
No, it does not become a not guilty plea, or it does not become a finding of not guilty. It is a finding of guilty in terms of the fact that the jury found every element necessary to determine that a crime was committed.
So at sentencing, the judge would be bound by what parameters?
The judge would be bound by the jury's failure to find any fact that increased the penalty above the default maximum. So we have a valid conviction. All the elements of the offense have been found beyond a reasonable doubt. The problem is we just don't have a finding of that additional fact that bumps the penalty up above the default maximum.
So it would be the minimum in that.
So what the defendant could be sentenced to under those circumstances is the default maximum, 3.5 years.
Right.
But he could still be sentenced. He's guilty. He's subject to being sentenced. It's only a question of what sentence he gets.
By default maximum, you're referring to the maximum he could have received for the lowest amount of quantity,
yes,
which
exactly.
The proscribed conduct would have exposed him.
Which is the class I 3.5 years. Right. Well,
even if he says he had 25 plants, he was charged with having 250. So he says, okay, I only had 25.
Okay, that would bump him up to a class H.
That's what I'm saying. The question is, whatever he admits to, he gets that penalty.
That's what the penalty he gets.
Okay, here's...
It cannot exceed that. You say a penalty. That's what he gets. It cannot exceed that.
It can't exceed the maximum for the number of plants that he admits growing.
Your argument makes sense the way this statute is drafted. This statute is drafted to say that it is unlawful for any person to manufacture, distribute, or deliver a controlled substance or controlled substance analog. That's the crime.
That is a crime.
That's the way the statute reads. The next section, the next sentence in that statute says, any person who violates this subsection, which I just read you, is subject to the following penalties. Then you get to marijuana, and then it has a whole list. Now, suppose the statute didn't, and that's what you're relying on. You're looking at the statute.
Right. You have one part that defines the crime.
Absolutely.
And the next part that states the penalties.
Penalty. And then you say, hey, you look at the crime. There's what the facts are. He admits to those facts. Boom. Guilty. Now we go to the penalty. Statute didn't have to be drafted this way. Statute could have been drafted, rather than all these subsections, it could have said, it's unlawful for any person to manufacture, distribute, or deliver a controlled substance or controlled substance analog when the person has, and then add all the language about marijuana, four or fewer plants, guilty of a Class 1 felony. Then you could have had another section that said all of the factors that go to Class H, Class G, Class F. It's drafted with a crime and penalties. That's not the only way you could draft the statute, right?
That's right. Sure.
Now, suppose it's drafted the way I want to draft it. So everything is separate. And that's it is a felony if you manufacture, distribute, or deliver a controlled substance or a controlled substance analog in the amount of, bad drafting, but 200 grams or less, or four or fewer plants containing marijuana. Would your argument be the same?
No. No, it would be very different.
What would your argument be?
I would have to concede that if the statute was drafted in a way which said that the defendant is guilty if he manufactures a controlled substance and he manufactures, well, let's say in the case of marijuana, between 5 and 20 plants, then he's guilty. If that's the way the statute read, then that would be an element of the
crime. In that instance, the state could request a lesser-included offense at the time of trial.
Yeah, yeah. Each of those would be a separate crime under that drafting of the statute.
Well, it could be a separate crime and a lesser-included even as the statute is drafted, right? You could have a lesser-included.
The way the statute is drafted now?
No, under her hypothetical.
Oh, under your hypothetical, yeah.
But not the way the statute is drafted now?
The statute is drafted now.
Right. No. My point is, in asking you about that, my understanding of Apprendi was to avoid just this point, that you don't look at how the statute is drafted so that what the statute defines as elements of what the statute just defines as penalties. What you look at to determine for federal constitutional purposes is what do you have to take to the jury to find as a matter of fact. You disagree with my reading of Apprendi. Is that right?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes. If you are reading Apprendi to say that Apprendi holds that a fact that increases the penalty is an element of the underlying substantive offense, then yes, I do disagree with you. If Apprendi says that at all, and in particular, if you look at Justice Scalia's concurrence, which I have discussed in my brief, his concurrence says, well, that's what I would have held. I would have held that any fact that you have to take to the jury is an element of the crime. That's what I would have held, but, the majority didn't agree with me.
In this case, as I understand it, the complaint identifies a particular, is it paragraph or lower than paragraph? For example, if the complaint had said the defendant is charged with 961, 41, 1H, then the amount of substance manufactured would have been left wide open. And if a particular amount wasn't approved, it would have a default. But here, there was a pinpoint. And are you saying that the pleading of that pinpointed amount is really kind of irrelevant?
It's not an element. The pleading
is irrelevant, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's irrelevant to conviction for the crime. It is relevant to the potential penalty that Mr. Cain faced upon conviction for the underlying crime. That's why that subsection was cited, not for purposes of alleging what crime he committed, but for purposes of alleging what penalty he would be subject to if he was convicted of that crime.
Proof of 1,000 feet, without proof of 1,000 feet would be insufficient for conviction, says Harvey. That's just loose drafting.
I think it's loose language. Yeah, that's what I think. You didn't, in Harvey, you never really considered this issue.
Well,
it was never actually presented to you. You never had to decide it. So, that's all you had to decide was that unless the state proved that it was within a certain distance of the school, you couldn't sentence him. But I think the critical thing that, as I said about Harvey, is that it talks about penalty enhancers. It does talk about penalty, not about elements to prove guilt.
But it also says that proof of that penalty enhancer is necessary for a conviction.
Yeah, I know. And as I say, you never really had to take into account the dichotomy that I'm suggesting to you today. So, you know, you just used language that I think was a little fuzzier, a little more ambiguous than we need to use in addressing the decision in this case.
You know, counsel, I'm trying to think of this from a practical matter, but if the defense is right here, then in the future what the state should do is allege every possible crime underneath the maximum amount of plants so that the jury can make a determination of if is it 20 or fewer plants, is it 4 or fewer plants, is it, and if the defense is right, couldn't the defendant be convicted of each of those if those are separate elements and separate offenses, such that a defendant could be convicted of having 4 or fewer plants and 20?
Well,
or fewer
plants? I think you're going back to the chief's hypothetical on drafting the statute.
Right.
Under that hypothetical, those would be lesser included offenses, and you can't be convicted of a lesser included and the greater offense, only one or the other.
Well, or conversely, then the state should just allege a violation of the underlying statute and then later sort of let the defendant know what the penalties might be.
Well, under Apprendi, you have to allege the penalty enhancer in the complaint.
I don't disagree with you, which is why it's not an element. It goes to the sentence.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see how you get around that, which is why I thought I was giving the defense an underhand pitch initially.
Yeah, it has to be alleged in the complaint.
It has to be alleged in the complaint, and if you're going to do a plea hearing, you've got to tell the defendant how much he is exposed to.
And he was.
He was told the upper amount.
He was told he faced
and
6 years.
So that fits in with our other cases, which say, hey, even if the court's wrong about the maximum penalty that you tell the defendant, that's harmless error.
At the very least, harmless error. I don't think it's error at all.
Well, the court wasn't wrong here. That is, the charge is what it was.
Yeah.
The admission was to something else.
Yeah, it's just the admission problem.
Justice Prosser has his hand up.
If I were unfortunate enough to get this case, what would you want me to, and decided for the state in a sense, what would you want me to write about Apprendi and Harvey and other cases that might suggest that this was an element?
Suggest that it was an element?
Yeah.
I think you'd have to follow the public defender's brief if that's what you wanted to suggest. But like I told the chief, I don't think Apprendi says it's an element of the offense. I think Apprendi very clearly, if you read it in its entirety and you read it closely and clearly, does make that dichotomy between an element of the crime and an element of the penalty. Both have to be charged, both have to be proved, but they go to different things. One to the conviction, one to the sentence. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Attorney Moses.
Thank you. So I would just like to start with going off of a little bit of what the state has just talked about and why their approach is completely impractical. One of the things they mentioned is the separation between a plea and a sentence and a separation between crime and a penalty. And the fact that in this case, Mr. Kane's conviction was for a Class H felony at the plea hearing, even though he denied that element. And the state then said at sentencing, if Mr. Kane never made the statement about 5 plants, that he could then only be sentenced according to an I felony. But in this case, his conviction was for an H felony. So the approach that we've developed today, it's a practical approach because it talks about finality and certainty at the plea hearing. It doesn't enable a sentencing court then to just change the conviction around. Mr. Kane's conviction was to an H felony at sentencing. He shouldn't just be able to be then sentenced according to an I felony. I mean, it doesn't change his conviction at all.
Well, why aren't you just asking to change the conviction to fit the record? Record shows he pleads guilty to having marijuana, right? Just the way the statute says. And this doubt as to whether he has pled to the requisite number, right? So why, and it probably is worse for him to have a conviction for the higher felony than the lower one. But he's agreed that he had marijuana. So why can't you just say, this goes back, there's an error in the conviction. Conviction should be for the lower offense. He's been sentenced for the lower offense. So long, goodbye.
Well, we believe that the remedy in a case like this is plea withdrawal, and it's the error that happened at the plea hearing. So in order to make sure that the plea hearing is a sound hearing and the pleas knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered, the procedures at a plea hearing need to be followed. Mr. Cain desires plea withdrawal in this case. If the court is not willing to do that, and the only thing they're willing to do is to sua sponte, change the conviction to an I felony, Mr. Cain would be happy with that. But he does believe that plea withdrawal is the correct remedy and the remedy that he desires in this case.
Now, we haven't talked about manifest interest, right? Manifest justice, sorry. Where post-sentencing, the concept is you don't change anything unless there's manifest injustice. There are lots of different meanings for manifest injustice, but at least there are two that might affect this case. One is there's no factual basis, right? Two is that it is not a knowing, involuntary, and knowing, intelligent, involuntary plea, right?
Correct. Although I struggle with the factual basis component a little bit because there's cases, and Thomas says that the defendant doesn't need to even admit to a factual basis in their own words, and that the defense attorney's statements can suffice. They can admit to statements in the criminal complaint. So in that sense, I think a factual basis could be established, but I don't think that it should have even gotten to that point, because once Mr. Cain denied an element, the court shouldn't have just then got to the factual basis determination. The other alternatives that I proposed in my brief should have happened at that point.
That's an either an Alford plea or you don't take the plea and
trial.
You set it up for trial.
Or the court could have inquired with Mr. Cain, asked him a couple more questions, and maybe, in doing that, he would have admitted to the offense that he was charged with, and then the conviction would be valid. But in this case, that's not what happened.
Does it make any difference he pled no contest?
Excuse me?
Does it make any difference to you that he pled no contest?
No, it does not. I think that, no contest is just saying I'm not contesting the state can prove me guilty of this offense, but he explicitly denied an element of the offense in this case. And Alford pleas can be taken, usually it's a guilty plea, but there are cases, I believe, that it's when it's a no contest plea also. So if the person is claiming innocence, that's when an Alford plea would be taken, but then there's special procedures that need to be in place and special caution that needs to be taken, a different finding of factual basis at that time.
Any further questions, or do you have
my light just went on, so I'm finished. Do you have any other questions? I guess I will have a moment, I guess, just to we ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals holding that once a defendant denies an element of the offense they're pleading to, the correct procedure is to stop the proceeding and set it for trial. And in this case, we also believe that in a reviewing court should only be limited to the plea hearing, what happened at the plea hearing, because that's the relevant proceeding and the time to make sure that the plea is being entered knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both Ms. Moses and Mr. Balistrieri for their arguments today in yet another plea withdrawal and plea colloquy case with a twist of Apprendi and Harvey. That concludes our hearing in 10-AP-1599 CR, State versus Kane. The students may remain. Justice Bradley will be out to talk with them. The court is in recess until 1:30 for our third case today.